from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Friday, February 23rd, 1945, at around 1 o'clock p.m., 5 days after American Marines landed at Iwo Jima. Photographer Joe Rosenthal was making his daily visit to the island on a Marine landing craft when he heard that a flag was being raised atop Mount Suribachi, a volcano at the southern tip of the island. Rosenthal hurried toward Suribachi carrying his bulky speed graphic camera, but Rosenthal got bad news about halfway up. He was told that the flag had already been raised and he'd missed the moment. But he continued on, and at the summit, he discovered a group of Marines attaching a larger flag to a length of pipe. Nearby, another group of Marines stood ready to lower the smaller flag at the same instant the larger was raised. So Rosenthal piled stones in a sandbag to give him a better vantage point. He was, after all, only 5'5". He noticed the Marines raising the flag, and he turned his camera around toward the action. He captured history, his iconic photo known as the flag-raising photo. I know you've seen it. That clunky camera, the speed graphic, was an industry standard in Rosenthal's time, and that very camera that he used at Iwo Jima is now on display as part of the George Eastman House's historic collection of camera technology. It's just one of many. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers is getting ready to honor the George Eastman House as a historic mechanical engineering landmark. This hour, we're taking a tour through history and talking about just that subject with our panel. My guests for the hour in studio include Todd Gustafson, curator of the technology collection at the George Eastman House. Todd, nice to have you.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you.
Joseph Lawson is president of the Rochester section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Joseph, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also, here's John Kriegel, a past chair and a member of the History and Heritage Committee of the Rochester section of ASME. John, nice to have you.
Thank you.
And also here's Brad Paxton, a member of the Technology Collection Acquisitions Committee at George Eastman House. Brad, thanks for being here.
Okay.
On the line with us, from Sterling, Virginia, is Dr. Lawrence Lee, who's the past chair of the American Society of Mechanical Engineering History and Heritage Committee, and he's going to put some things in context for us. Larry, are you there?
I am here, and I appreciate the invitation.
Well, thank you very much. So on Monday, 6 p.m., there's a big ceremony as the George Eastman House gets this honor, and I'm told that it is now one of 250-something. How many different landmarks are we talking about around the country?
257 is the correct number of landmarks, collections, and heritage sites.
And what exactly, I think we can kind of guess, but walk us through what exactly this means and how this designation is made.
The History and Heritage Program at ASME started in 1971 with the idea to look seriously at the artifacts that engineers have created over the years that have made significant impacts on our society, our culture, way of life, and on the future of mechanical engineering. The first landmark was in 1973, the cable cars in San Francisco, as you know them. The fifth landmark was the first one in New York, which were a pair of Boyden turbines in Cohoes, north of Albany, New York, that powered a large mill there. Even though the mill's now residences, the turbines are still there and can be seen. The idea was to document this because a lot of these things tend to go away over time. They're not always as survivable as buildings, and so we wanted to recognize them, encourage their preservation, and call public attention to them. We publish a brochure about them so that people can that are interested can read about them and see the impact and how they were done and know about the people that created them. And in addition, see the landmarks themselves and get a handle on just what it was that helped make modern life. We also have an engineer historian program where we like to recognize engineers who have contributed to the history of their society, our society, honor them, and again, to recognize their works. We've also published a couple of free things ourselves on our landmarks. The third book, Machines That Made History, is now available either through Amazon or ASME, that covers, I believe it's 101, the selected out of the 257 landmarks to look at. It's more of a coffee table format, so it's accessible to just about everyone who would Be interested in interesting things.
Well, Dr. Lee, I'm not going to quiz you on all 257, but are there any others, before we really dive into George Eastman House and this technological collection they have, this remarkable collection, are there any other that stand out to you that's sort of within drivable distance for the aficionados in our listening audience?
Well, yes, indeed, there are. There are a couple in Lockport, the Holly system of fire protection and water distribution and power system there. Good portions of that have been obliterated over the year, but there's some key elements there to be seen. And, of course, the people at the Heritage Center there know a good bit about it as well. There are, I mentioned the ones at Cohoes. That's a good day's drive, but it's there. Buffalo has the first device that was ever done. It's called a marking piano, where a performer could sit down and play a regular piano, and his actions were all recorded on a strip of paper so that player piano rolls could be made from it that were not just mechanical, but artistic in nature. That's in Buffalo. Let's see, that gives you a good idea. There's an ironworks in Westmoreland, a little bit further away. The Coulot Kinematics Collection, one of all kinds of basic mechanisms, where a fellow at Cornell produced these to use as demonstrations for his students, so that you could understand how basic mechanisms performed and how you could change one kind of motion to another, this sort of thing. So that's just a few of them. There are a couple, three, of course, closer to New York City. Many of your readers, I'm sure, will have been to Radio City Music Hall and not realized that all of the fancy things they could do with the stage and move it up and down and all around and pieces within it are a very complicated hydraulic system. That's another one of our landmarks.
I want to ask. I just want to ask John Kriegel. You were sort of smiling about several of these, John. Did you want to weigh in on that?
So in Binghamton, there's a Link, the Link trainer that was pretty significant to World War II, has been commemorated in Binghamton, and I wanted.
Yes.
I'm glad you mentioned the one from the Corning area or the Cornell University mechanisms. I think that has STEM implications given today's pressure on education.
And so we're talking to Dr. Lawrence Lee. Before I let you go, sir, who's joining us from Sterling, Virginia, and before I turn it over to our studio panel for the rest of the hour as we talk about the George Eastman House's honor, Dr. Lee, the George Eastman House is on this list now, 257 landmarks around the country, chosen by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, and as the past chair of their History and Heritage Committee. Why the George Eastman House? Why this honor now?
Well, you have this honor actually, or the nomination for it, actually started some years ago, and because of some, unfortunate personnel moves and shifts and things like that, it actually fell through the cracks a little bit, and we wondered if anybody out there was still interested. So we made contact again and found some people. Yes, we are. John Kriegel among them, of course. And the Eastman House people were still interested. This is an astounding collection of every manner of, I guess you would say, image collection and processing on it. We think of photography now as just something that's almost automatic. I mean, people pick up a cell phone, and I used to pick up a landline phone and thought it was great to talk to people. Just pick it up and snap a picture. And then you look at the high class, everything from the types of things that are shown in the IMAX theaters with the, like, on-orbit photography and the like. We had photography from the moon. Everything is recorded now in some kind of image. Not just the pictures are important, though they certainly are, but how they were made, how the technology grew and developed that made it possible to do this. Photography is only no less than a couple of hundred years old in any fashion. So it's a relatively modern technology, but one that has just become ubiquitous and vitally important in recording our history. So the Eastman House, with a superb collection of these things, all of these instruments, and some of them, like was mentioned on the intro of Joe Rosenthal's camera that he took the wonderful shot in Mount Suribachi's flag raising, that you have these. The speed graphic is, of course, important just because it was the standard during that era, and yet this specific one took a decidedly extraordinary photograph. So, beautiful representation there, and the number of that kind of thing at Eastman House, I can't tell you, but it's quite substantial, both of the important things and important examples of them.
Well,
so, yes, it's a collection that really needed to be on our roster. We have nothing else like it.
Well, that'll be the job of the panel for the rest of the hour, then, to really detail some of the great things at the George Eastman House. But that is a tremendous introduction to this honor and the event that's coming up Monday. Dr. Lawrence Lee joining us from Sterling, Virginia, the past chair of the American Society of Mechanical Engineering History and Heritage Committee. Thanks for taking the time, Larry. It's great to talk to you on this program, and thanks for sharing some insight on what the award means.
My pleasure. Delighted to be with you, and I know your audience is going to learn a lot over the next hour.
You got it, sir. Thanks very much. It's Larry Lee. All right. So let's talk to the panel here in studio about that. I chose Joe Rosenthal's camera, the camera that captured the flag raising at Iwo Jima. But there are so many others. I mean, we could go down the list, and that's what I kind of would like to do this hour, is talk about some of the remarkable cameras, Ansel Adams' first cameras, the 1888 Kodak, the 1900 Brownie. But let me start with Joe Rosenthal's camera. It captured the flag raising. How do you get that camera? Where does that come from? I guess Todd Gustafson and Brad Paxton can help us understand that. But how do you end up getting that camera?
Well, being in Rochester, New York, which happens to be the center of photography, at least it was at the time, still is. There were many collections in town here. That was part of the Rosenthal camera was part of a corporate collection, which was donated to the museum by Graflex. They put the collection together in the 50s. They used it as part of public relations for the company, and over the years they originally put the collection on loan and donated the entire collection. So it's not only just the Rosenthal camera, it's their entire collection. So it's pretty much a sample of every camera that they made. Some of them have interesting provenance. There was a camera that was on the USS West Virginia when it sunk at Pearl Harbor. So I mean it's more than just the Rosenthal camera. And typically we get things, onesies and twosies. It's either, for instance, on my way in the door, I was pestering Nolan Stefani about a camera, and here I'm sitting next to a Sony television camera. So
from WXXI?
XXI, there we go.
Looking,
so,
yeah.
Actually, and you folks have been nice enough.
We've been dying to get rid of it. Thanks for taking it.
I'm dying to acquire it.
I'm mostly kidding.
So what? But that's kind of how it happens. I either get phone calls or emails, and also realize a good deal of this stuff was, and I'm using stuff in the photographic equipment meaning here. A lot of stuff was already here. I came to the museum 27 years ago. It was a fantastic collection, and we've increased the size of it probably by about a third since I've been here.
I mean, it sounds like Eastman and our community, just because of our history and photography, is a magnet for historical. If there's a historical image, particularly in sort of eras that predate the modern era where cameras are ubiquitous, even in our cell phones, it seems like they make their way here somehow.
Right. Eastman Kodak Company had a large collection of cameras over the years. They kept a collection of theirs and plus the competitor cameras for various reasons, whether it's to make sure the film went through properly, patent models. I recently have received the world's oldest known DSLR from the engineer who built it. So a lot of times there's things like this. It's thoughtful people who realized these things were important and wanted to see that they got put in a place that would take care of them. And that's what we do.
Todd, are there cameras out there that you know have captured big moments, important moments that you don't have that you want?
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's an everyday event. I'm trying to store, an infinite amount of things in a finite space. So there's there's all sorts of things that I'd love to have. I put together a wish list. Some things are utterly ridiculous. I know there's two or three of them only. You know, I don't have an original Voigtlander daguerreotype.
You got to at least let us peek at one or two of the items on your wish list. What are?
Well, okay. I'd really love to have the seeing we're tucking the Rosenthal image. I'd really like to have the digital camera that captured the flag raising at Ground Zero in New York. It's a digital camera. I know it's out there. I'd love to have that camera. We can't have everything, you know. Some things are already spoken for. So sometimes it's a ridiculous wish. One of my museum patrons had asked me what I was looking for. I told him I would really like to have an English parlor Victorian viewer from the 1870s, and 3 days ago he brought one in for me. So, I mean, it's stuff like that.
From the 1870s?
Yeah.
Who has that? I mean, that's just really remarkable.
Right. I mean, I made the request about 10 or 12 years ago, and this gentleman he put it in the back burner, and eventually he found one for me. So,
but are we at the end now? Are we in an era where a lot has changed in that essentially cell phone technology has changed the amount of people who have cameras? Most of the pictures that are shared around the world right now are being shared through these mobile technologies and cell phones and whatnot. Are we going to see less of, you know, sort of an iconic image captured by a camera anymore?
It's an interesting question. You know, if you look at the Pulitzer Prize winning images from the 1940s, 50s, they're all taken with a speed graphic except for one. There was one image that was made with a Brownie camera in the 1950s. So trying to decide what a camera is and what it does relative to, I don't know, its point of purchase cost is really not the best way to look at it. I mean, another way to look at this is the Brownie camera was the ubiquitous camera from the 1900. You know, it came out, sold for a dollar. Ansel Adams' first camera, by the way, was a Brownie. His first camera was a 15-year-old number one Brownie.
Wow.
So, but here's the thing. Today's version of the same thing is the smartphone.
Yeah.
So before I came to the Eastman House, I really didn't have a very high opinion of the Brownie cameras. They were just inexpensive cameras for kids. Now that I've been enlightened. You look at these things a little bit differently after you sort of line them up and you decide, well, you know, these are important. It's what got people taking pictures. It's really was popular photography. The smartphone is the same thing. So, sure, the yesterday's Brownie is today's smartphone.
We're talking about the remarkable collection at the George Eastman House of their camera technology being honored by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. And in a moment, we're going to tell you what's coming up on Monday, but I'm kind of hung up on the speed graphic because we mentioned it several times. That was Joe Rosenthal's camera, and I know nothing about it. So can someone tell us what the speed graphic was? I'd love to know more about it. I guess, Todd, yeah?
Back to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, the speed graphic was the standard press camera used by, it's a 4x5. Today, I'd call it a view or a field camera. It was handheld. In its day, it was considered to be convenient and portable. It took a high-quality 4x5-inch negative. There's lots of pixels there. Mr. Paxson can do the math on that, I'm sure. But it was the standard camera. It's sort of like the DSLR that's used by pro photographers today. Everybody used them. It was the standard camera. The one that he used, by the way, was a civilian camera. There was also military versions of those that would have a military plaque underneath. It's really interesting when you look at this. It was the standard press camera from about 1935 until around 1960. If you look at the footage of Lee Harvey Oswald being moved out in Texas, there were people using speed graphics in 1963. So it had a really long shelf life.
I've heard the term bulky, clunky. Do we know how much it weighed?
It's the camera physical size, the box is about 8 inches square, about 8 inches deep. It weighs about 10 pounds.
About 10 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, again, think about how history has changed. Our cell phone weighs a few ounces.
Yeah. The main difference, I mean, if you look at the pro DSLRs that the photojournalists use, they're pretty heavy depending on the lens on it. The main difference is the speed graphic was giving you pretty much a one shot at a time deal because you've got to change film holders or film packs. With the modern cameras, you can just blast away almost like shooting motion pictures.
Okay, so I'm trying to get in my head a picture of this moment of the flag raising at Iwo Jima, because what I've read about speed graphic, and again, the panel can help me understand if I'm wrong about this, but, you know, good quality for the time, but, you know, not perfect. The shot is iconic. It is one that we've all seen. It's poignant. It's beautiful. Was this a fortunate shot, right place, right time? I'm trying to get a sense for, you know, just how fortunate we are that he got the image he got, that Rosenthal got that image. Because how quickly could he have gotten a second image with that speed graphic? You know, how did that work?
Yeah, in the old days, press photographers used to use the phrase F8 and be there. You know, it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of knowing where to be, but you also have to be ready. He kept the dark slide pulled, so he was ready to make the image. So sure, he was in the right place at the right time. On the other hand, he also got the image. So it's just as they said, F8 and be there.
If he had turned and gotten a poor shot or a blurry image or moving image and had to reload for another, how long would it have taken him to get another?
Well, he's got to pull out the holder, turn it around, put it in, and pull the dark slide. Somebody who's quick can probably do that in about 30 seconds. But in the case of this thing, 30 seconds, you're going to miss the shot.
You lose it. So he essentially had one chance, and he got it.
Yeah.
Amazing. And you can see the camera right now at George Eastman House, among many others. How many in the collection?
The collection size is about 16,000 objects, and that's all kinds of photographic technology, from cameras for both still and motion pictures, lenses, light meters, tripods, cable releases, I mean, all the paraphernalia. Right. As far as cameras specifically, there's about 8,500.
And you said that speed graphic weighed about 10 pounds. I am a big fan of the photojournalists that I know in this town. And it's great that we still have photojournalists still working today. When I started working in television, a lot of our photographers down in West Virginia were using Beta cameras, and some of them weighed 42, 44 pounds. Imagine 44 pounds on your shoulder for about 4 hours a day. And you see why everyone had surgery. It was sort of a rite of passage. You know, Paul DePascal, who is the chief photographer at 13WAM and one of the really, really good people in town, has had surgery on just about every joint and arm part that he has because of that. So 10 pounds for the speed graphic. Modern photographers, it has changed. But Brad Paxton, as a member of the Technology Acquisitions Committee at the George Eastman House, what is on your wish list? What is out there that you would love to bring in?
Well, I'm trying to help Todd collect and curate electronic imaging devices. In particular.
Electronic imaging?
Yeah, electronic, like digital cameras, digital printers, transceivers, and that sort of thing. We recently collected a complete still video system from the mid-80s out of our respective basements, and we collected all these things at my company in a spare lab, and plugged them all together and were astonished to find that they all still worked.
Wow.
Which is going back to 1987. The still video system was based on a still video floppy disk about 2 inches in diameter, in which you could store 25 high-quality video images in circular tracks. And so that was the basis of the system. The transceiver was Kodak's first digital product, and it got a lot of attention because the famous pictures of Tiananmen Square with a fellow with his hands up in front of the tank, mm-hmm. They had video of that, and they wanted to send it back to New York, and the Chinese had eliminated the video links, and there was not, you know, it's a little bit difficult to spirit a VHS tape from China to the United States and 2 minutes. So it turned out CBS had the foresight to buy a couple of our transceivers, and they used the transceiver to send that picture back to New York, and they did a little short piece on it. Todd has a video of it, and Kodak got an Emmy Award for that product because it captured a lot of attention in the media.
Great
but he
stuff.
Has the complete still video system there, and then another one of my favorites over there is the Lunar Orbiter payload. The Lunar Orbiter was the spacecraft that encircled the moon in 1966 and photographed the entire surface of the moon, both what we call the front and back sides from our perspective, and prepared the way for the Apollo landings. And that was done at Lincoln Plant in Rochester by Kodak people, and I was on that project as a young engineer.
All right, so you're telling us that's on the wish list or you have it?
Well, he has the payload. We believe it's number 7. They flew 5. So I guess if I had a personal wish, I'd like to know where number 6 is. because it might have some parts on it that would round out the event a little bit.
Well, let me grab a phone call. Chad and Henrietta wants to jump in on that World War II photograph. Go ahead, Chad. Are you there, Chad? Do we have Chad? I can't hear him. Chad, it's probably our own. Maybe we should recycle some of our technology to a museum. But Chad, you can call back. I'm just kidding. That was probably the host's malfunction. Chad, call back and you can pop into the conversation. And if you want to join the conversation as we kind of take a tour through the history of photography and what the George Eastman House has and this honor they are receiving, you can call the program 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Our guests for the hour in studio are Todd Gustafson and Brad Paxton. They are with the George Eastman House. Todd is the curator of the technology collection of the George Eastman House, and Brad, a member of the Technology Collection Acquisitions Committee. John Kriegel is a member of the History and Heritage Committee of the Rochester Section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. He's a past chair, and Joseph Lawson is president of the Rochester Section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Chad is back, and I'm going to try again. I hope I've got you there. Go ahead, Chad.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Sure.
Listen, I grew up in the 50s, and I still have a speed graphic and because it was left to me by my uncle. But the story with respect to the Iwo Jima photograph I've heard was that after the first flag went up, it was then reenacted a couple of times for the photographer. Mm. So we were talking about, being there at the right time in the right place. He was certainly there at the right place and the right time, but it wasn't an instantaneous thing, according to the stories I've heard from the guys who put the flag up.
I hadn't heard that. Do we know anything about that, Todd?
Well, there are actually two images. The image that's the well-known image was the one that he saw when he got there, and again, it was the second flag raising. There is a second image, which was the staged image, and it's actually the folks who had raised the flag are now kind of in a straight line, so they're kind of lined up.
But that's not the one that we typically see.
That's not the one that we typically see. We do have a copy of that image also at the Eastman House, by the way, but the flag-raising image, again, was the image that Rosenthal saw when he got there.
Interesting. Chad, thank you. And you said you still got the speed graphic?
I do. I'm a hoarder, I guess. I can't get rid of this old technology. But I remember visiting Kodak and talking with the soon-to-retire director of international sales. And I showed him my first little Casio digital camera. And I said, Bud, what are you going to do about this? And he said, Kodak is not afraid of digital photography because the consumer will always want better quality, and we will be 3 steps ahead with film photography over digital photography. Just a story I'm sharing with you.
Thank you, Chad. Maybe a story best shared without comment, given the history of Kodak. Let me grab Frank and Webster. Go ahead, Frank.
Has anyone mentioned yet that the Joe Rosenthal speed graphic camera was made in Rochester, like all of them were?
Here.
That's a great point. Yeah, John Kriegel saying here.
I'm surprised Todd didn't bring that up.
Well, yes.
Todd, it's Frank Calandra.
Hey, Frank. What are you up to these days? It's been a while since I've seen you. Frank is a longtime friend of mine. Yes, the speed graphic was made in Rochester. Actually, Graflex was part of, originally it was a company that started in New York City about in the 1890s. They made bicycles, believe it or not, and gas lighting fixtures. They moved into making cameras. The company was moved to Rochester after George Eastman bought them. So they were a division of Eastman Kodak Company till about 1925. They split off, became former Graflex and then Graflex Inc. So yes, it's a long time Rochester company. They really made high quality professional type cameras.
And Evan, that's right off the top of his head, by the way.
He's amazing. You're absolutely right about that. Brad Paxton wanted to jump in as well. Go ahead, Brad.
Well, indeed, the speed graphic was a high resolution, excellent camera. I did a back of the envelope because Todd said I could figure out. I would say estimate it at 80 megapixels equivalent.
Now explain to us non-megapixelers what that means.
Well, this iPhone that I'm waving around, that nobody can see on the radio. The world's largest selling electronic camera, by the way.
Yeah.
Has an 8-megapixel sensor in it for the good pictures going forward. 2 megapixels for the selfies.
Which is a factor of 10 smaller than what you just calculated.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was a high-quality camera, no doubt.
Very good.
And see, the 4x5-inch film size allowed press photographers to basically make a one-to-one contact print. So there's no resolution loss when you enlarge things. So that's why they wanted to use that big. So, yeah, it's an incredible resolution camera.
Frank, any follow-up before we let you go, sir?
I just want to let Todd know that I have all my digital cameras that I bought over the years ready to donate.
I'll take you up on that, Frank.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank
nice
you, Frank.
With you.
So I'm way late for a break, and I'm way late to tell you about what is coming up on Monday as the American Society of Mechanical Engineers honors the George Eastman House for their collection number 257 in a series of national landmarks honored by the American Society. And John Kriegel and Joseph Lawson can help us understand really the meaning of that and what's coming up on Monday. So let's get that short break in and talk much more about the history on display at Eastman and what's coming up on Monday right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections, it's Education Friday. Animal education, we're talking to the folks from the Seneca Park Zoo about summer programs. And the start of a new series for Education Friday, The Classes You Wish You Could Have Taken. We're going to talk to some folks from Nazareth College as we ask, what are the college classes that are the most interesting, the most unique, the kind that stand out and make you wish you had taken them? Talk to you Friday.
Inmates in solitary confinement are often the most dangerous, so why do they go from isolation to freedom without mental health care or job training?
I went from solitary confinement straight to my mom's. No reintegration. I begged for help. Get me ready. Help me.
Solitary to the Streets later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on this, your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections, and John Kriegel, a member of the History and Heritage Committee of the Rochester Section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, just wanted to add to some of the conversation we've been having about that remarkable moment with Joe Rosenthal, 1945, at Iwo Jima as the photographer. What did you want to add there, John?
I think if I was one of the GIs standing around watching that and saw the second raising and the cameraman doing his thing, you'd say it was staged for him, which in fact it was not. It was because the flag was bigger and they were putting higher on the hill and a better flag. So it would be easy for the story that it was staged for the photographers to get around and not be true.
Yeah. So, again, I think the part of the message here, John, is that it really was a remarkable moment, that he was there and you know, fortunate for all of us who've seen that image over the years. Joseph Lawson, Monday, 6 p.m. at the George Eastman House. Public welcome. What's going on?
We have a wonderful event. So everyone in the many people in the Rochester community have great ties to this collection. They've been involved in creating part machines that are in there, in the images, former Kodakers. So we're welcoming people to the designation ceremony. So 6 p.m. at the Dryden Theater at the George Eastman House, we're having a designation ceremony where we're going to actually present the Landmark Award. There's a plaque that we give them and do some background, show some of the effects that are in there. We can't actually, unfortunately, take anyone into the archives, but we do have some documentation to show just how extensive the archives is, because the archives themselves are incredible if you can walk in, if you're fortunate enough to get such a tour. So we're doing a wonderful ceremony. Following that ceremony, we're having a reception within the George Eastman House. So if people are interested in coming and honoring the George Eastman House technology collection, they can then go and actually see the public displays of not only the technology collection, but some of the other public collections they have as well.
Cost to attend or RSVP?
We do ask people to RSVP so that we can accommodate the reception afterwards. So if you're interested in RSVPing, the RSVP site's a little bit long to give on the radio. So what I would recommend is ASME.org, which is our national organization's website. go to that site and just do a search for Rochester, Rochester section. We have our own subsite on there, and there's a link that you can go to RSVP.
For the event on Monday, ASME.org. That's the American Society of Mechanical Engineers.org. Search for the Rochester chapter.
No charge.
And John is telling us no charge. That's an important part of it.
But we do ask you to RSVP so that we have enough to go around.
Okay, and that's so it all starts Monday night at 6 p.m. And this honor, this is sort of 11 years in the making, John Kriegel. So kind of take me back through history here. You were a past chair of the local chapter of ASME, and you thought the Eastman House and this collection was a good fit 11 years ago.
Yeah, we identified it as a candidate site 11 years ago. And then work pressures and change of staff and whatever reasons, nobody chased it. And I came back after retiring from Eastman Kodak and said, is that still something we could do? And everybody said, yeah. In fact, we've been holding it in queue. I called a guy in New York who remembered me from 11 years earlier, and we picked it up where we left off.
Some of our listeners on Twitter have been sharing their thoughts on iconic images throughout history. And what's fascinating is how many of the images were captured by cameras that you can find at the George Eastman House's collection. Mim, by the way, mentions the Afghan girl. He said Steve McCurry's pick of the Afghan girl in those eyes. I don't remember. I think that's in the last 10 or 15 years. I could be wrong.
Yeah, that was shot on Kodachrome with a Nikon FM2. I don't have the camera. I have one like it.
Do you know, is there any picture that's ever been taken that you don't know?
That's what they pay me to do.
I want to spend the rest of the hour just quizzing you.
Well, actually, I spent a bit of time with Steve McCurry at an event at Chautauqua Institution. He actually shot some images with my D200, which is kind of funny. Yeah.
And so that image of the Afghan girl, I know the image. I'm trying to remember if that was on Time Magazine's cover or National Geographic cover. A remarkable image there. And again, what was the camera?
Nikon FM2.
Okay.
It's a mechanical film camera.
It's still used?
Oh, yeah, sure.
My wife, who's a photographer, is going, it's killing me, Evan, that you don't know anything about cameras. But, you know, different skill sets, different skill sets.
Say, Evan?
Yes.
I'd just like to chime in on this one and say that now that I've been on the technology committee for a while and get to work with Todd, he is an awesome, you just saw a little snippet there, his awesome grasp of all of the things in the huge vault down there. I've walked through it with him and say, well, what's this? And he'll give you 5 minutes on anything. Off the top of his head.
Some of it might actually be right.
so true.
It's actually astonishing.
Well, I think we're seeing that. And if you go down the list just of what is there, we can't possibly in the next 15 minutes cover the breadth of it. But there are certain things that stand out. We mentioned Ansel Adams' first cameras, which were both Kodak cameras. His first camera was a Brownie?
Yeah, he received a Brownie from his aunt as a gift. He was going to make a trip to Yosemite. About 1917. So yeah, we ended up. Ansel Adams lived in Rochester in the 1950s. He gave that camera. Also his second camera, which was a Vest Pocket autographic special, a little bit better quality camera. He took both of them to Yosemite. So the images with it he made with them are very similar to the stuff that he's really well known for.
And the stuff that he is well known for, which by law appeared on the walls of every house in Ohio when I was growing up. I mean, everybody had Ansel Adams stuff
and calendars.
And calendars, just beautiful stuff. What were those generally shot with?
Well, he owned a bunch of different cameras. He shot with a Hasselblad for a while. He had a couple of folding plate cameras, lots of things. So photographers tend to have more than one camera. People who do this for a living tend to change things or have multiple examples of the same camera.
So his stuff that you can find there, and I found amazing, you've got a daguerreotype signed by Daguerre.
Yeah, the Giroux daguerreotype camera is usually considered to be the first commercially manufactured camera. We have one. It has a plaque on it that roughly translates that the company only guarantees the ones with Daguerre's signature on it. So we have one of those on display right now. It's 176 years old. Similar to it is what we believe is the oldest documented camera sold in the U.S. It was purchased by Dr. Samuel Bemis from the Boston area. It's basically about the same camera, but this one has the original receipt. It was purchased on April 15th for $76. And we also have about a dozen images that were made for that camera.
$76 in
1876.
In 1840. 1840?
Yeah. It's a lot of money.
That's what I was going to say. $76 in 1840. Somebody getting an inflation calculator. That is a lot of money.
Yeah, it's around the cost of a high-end professional DSLR and then some.
How do you end up, again, that's something that in my brain, I'm a kind of a process person. So you get... You not only acquire a camera, but you said you have the receipt.
We have the receipt for it.
He just kept the receipt.
Yeah. Amazing. They never threw anything away, apparently. But yeah, 12 images. Well, the other thing that's really misleading about that $76 price on April 15th of 1840, by the way, is the fact that most people didn't have an income then. So aside from the conversion rate, it's higher than that because people just generally didn't have a job then. So it, you know, you walk down the aisles in the collection, it's just mind-boggling what's in there. I mean, if I take people in and the first reaction isn't, wow, I'm disappointed. And I still go, wow, and I've been here for 27 years.
But when you want them to say, wow, what is the one thing that you know is going to make somebody say, wow? What's the one thing that you say, you know, if you really want to impress someone who's hard to impress, show them?
Well, I try to find out what their interests are. If they're a motion picture person, I walk them past Charles Rocher's Debris Parvo that has Mary Pickford's signature on the top. That's kind of a wow thing. If they're a mechanical person, I show them the Super Kodak 620, the first camera with automatic exposure, dating from 1938. The company was over 20 years ahead of the rest of the world. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's an incredible cookie jar of amazing things.
You said 1938?
1938.
First camera with
automatic exposure.
What's it look like?
It's actually a very attractive camera. It was designed by Walter Dorwin Teague. Kind of an Art Deco thing. You almost feel like it should have had a wind tunnel to go with it. But it's an amazing thing. They made very few of them. We have six at the collection. And again, automatic exposure. It was all done mechanically. Selenium cell connected to the aperture of the lens. Like a voltmeter, basically. The more light creates more electricity, and the aperture changes. Yeah, pretty amazing thing.
Do you have anything from, what was the, my first job, by the way, was at Moto Photo, when you could get your pictures back in 1 hour.
Oh.
And I've told the story, I remember the owner saying, this is the one thing that people will always need because you'll never be able to get your pictures back faster than an hour. It turned out he was wrong about that, and that did not turn out to be a great investment for my good friend Bruce back in Ohio with Moto Photo. But a pain at the time, there were two things that were the biggest pain. Whenever we got a roll of Seattle film, because there was some sort of different chemistry. So I had to change out all the chemistry to do Seattle film. And then the weird small Kodachrome, what was it?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Kodachrome or what was the Kodak did that alternative cartridge-y stuff that was supposed to, it wasn't Kodachrome, it was the...
Disc?
No.
Well, it probably sounds like...
Advantix.
Yeah, APS.
Oh, yeah. You know, so just showing you that even the most brilliant minds don't always have the best ideas.
Yeah, we have a complete set of APS cameras from all manufacturers worldwide.
People bought those.
Yes.
You know, interesting. And what was the deal with Seattle film?
Well, Seattle film was actually motion picture film. It didn't have the anti-scratch layer on it. I worked in a camera shop, so I'm
That was motion, with technically it was motion picture
it was motion
film.
Motion picture film, yeah. And it had a slightly different color balance, so you'd have to change the balance of the printers. But processing it was a little more complicated because it was very easy to scratch. But it was motion picture film, not still film.
Okay. Well, should it have been better quality then?
Quality was about the same. The color balance was different. Many labs didn't like it because there was only so many settings they could change. It was a little more complicated to set up is what it boiled down to.
Does it make you ache at all just to see people pick up a cell phone and take pictures instantly? Take images, I should say.
I think it's great. I mean, I shot a picture of Brad today with a model of the lunar orbiter they brought in. Oh, I use it all the time. In fact, I take more pictures now than I ever did. So I think as technically, you know, as technology has changed, photography's improved. Actually, if you look at it, there are more images made now on an hourly basis than ever before. It's actually more successful than ever before. I'm working on an exhibit that's talking about what came after the Kodak. We've got a show up that's talking about the original Kodak from 1888. I've been looking for a phrase to hang this on. I came up with a quote that George Eastman used in an interview in 1920, talking about making photography as convenient as using the pencil. And I think that's such a insightful comment. I mean, it's covering not only the images, but it's also talk about the communication, or at least that's certainly implied.
It was brilliant, really.
Well, and it was prescient because, you know, I don't think you could say that it was ever as easy as using a pencil until an iPhone, or until, I mean, it was close. I mean, I'm not saying it's difficult, but it is now. He's achieved that. I mean, long after his passing.
But photography has gone through a very long evolutionary phase. You know, it started out with fairly complicated process. The photographer had to be the artist and the chemist. To learn the process, you most likely had to go study with a working photographer. With George Eastman first introducing commercially manufactured plates, so you didn't have to make your own sensitized materials. That's what you're going to record the image on. And then adding the photo finishing industry in 1888. And from then on, in reality, it's been making it easier, increasing your picture-taking opportunity. So in other words, in the old days, it had to be, you know, take a picture of somebody. They had to be in the sunlight, looking in the face. It was only during the daytime. So we've added flash photography, faster lenses, better sensitized materials, and easier to use cameras. The fact that you can see the image as soon as you make it is amazing to me. But sure, and it will continue to evolve. That's what photography is. It's just a continuation of evolving technology.
If you're just joining us, we've got a few more minutes with our panel as we talk about the George Eastman House's technology collection, which is going to be recognized as a historic mechanical engineering landmark by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. And that ceremony is on Monday night. In just a few minutes, we'll make sure you've got the details again on if you'd like to attend. And just for a little bit of historical context, the Eastman House's collection becomes the 257th engineering marvel in this country, which gets a designation. They've been doing this for about 44 years. So not a lot of designations every year, and the Eastman House is on that list. And so Joseph Lawson, who's the president of the Rochester section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, just from a mechanical engineering standpoint, when people hear, oh, a collection of cameras, as a mechanical engineer, why is this a good fit?
It's an amazing fit. As a mechanical engineer, I work with cameras all the time. I work on technologies that can be incorporated into cameras. If you think about a camera, it's a very interdisciplinary project. There's electrical engineering that goes in there. There's every discipline you can imagine goes in there, but heavily mechanical engineering. The original cameras, they didn't have a lot of the electronics in order to make a camera work. So it had to be a lot of mechanical mechanisms that were used to actually move the film, move the shutter. It wasn't just an iPhone, which is all digital, computer controlled. So anything that a mechanical engineer could possibly build would be a part of this. And as a mechanical engineer, I am actually been involved with a lot of these technologies. So I know Brad and John both have worked on technologies that may well actually be part of this collection. I'm a rather young engineer, so nothing I've worked on is old enough vintage to be in there yet, but likely will be. Some of the products I've worked on when I was previously at Xerox. John, you actually want to point some out? Do you actually have one? Or?
Yeah, go ahead.
If he was done, I was thinking ASME is actually broader than North America or U.S. in scope as a organization, and the collections that they've noticed are also world-class. There's some outside the U.S. Just a comment from you.
And if you missed it earlier, of the 257 total landmarks that are on this list now, some of them, it sounds like, and maybe John can answer this for us, it sounds like some of them are in danger or have, you know, I don't know, fallen apart or you know, sort of they're, you hope that if something's designated as a landmark, it's going to be preserved. Mm-hmm. And so at the very least, the work that Todd and Brad are doing is going to preserve these remarkable cameras, et cetera, this collection for sure. But some of these mechanical engineering landmarks around the country are in danger, we're in danger of losing them?
I'm thinking that the bigger problem is what things have we failed to recognize that nobody knows should be being preserved rather than the ones that we've already recognized deteriorating.
Do certain things come to mind for you?
No.
Okay.
In fact, we would tackle that if
you're in the process.
Although it supposedly originates within the region, so upstate New York would be the candidate area for myself.
A few minutes left here. If people, Todd Gustafson, who's the curator of the technology collection of the George Eastman House, just on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, if people want to see the collection, when are you open?
Well, the collection is open to the public. The gallery's from 10 to 4:30. The collection by appointment, I will accommodate walk-ins if I can. I'm a one-man show, one-person department, so I can't always see everybody.
Oh, it's a radio show. I know exactly how you feel.
It's a challenge at times. Yeah. Just this morning, I mean, Brad was trying to call me, and I was giving a demonstration of the first motion picture projection device, the Lumiere Cinematograph, to our students. So, unfortunately, Brad, I'm sorry I couldn't take your call, but I was otherwise engaged.
So this is an appointment situation. People want to come out, make an appointment with you.
Yes.
How do they do that?
Just give me a call, send me an email. My email is pretty simple. It's Todd, T-O-D-D, at geh.org. It's actually too short, but I've been there for a while, so I have a very easy email.
And they can call the George Eastman House?
Or call us at 271-3361. My direct extension is 369. So, yeah, I'm usually in my office. If not, leave me a message. I'll call you back.
All right, Joseph Lawson, one more time. Monday night, 6 p.m., and you've got this this event that marks the honor for the George Eastman House, and the public can go. It is free. They do that how?
You just show up to the Dryden Theater would be one way. But we do ask that you RSVP. So if you were to go on to asme.org, and from that website, just type in the search bar Rochester. The first link that pops up is the Rochester section, and we have a link to RSVP right there. That'll actually save you a lot of trouble of trying to write down the entire RSVP link over the radio.
And so once you RSVP, it is free for Monday night, starting at 6 p.m., and give me a sense for how it unfolds Monday night.
So 6 p.m., we have a wonderful ceremony that we put together where we actually show some of the collections. The archives itself will be documenting that. People who have been instrumental to the technology collection in George Eastman House will be giving some presentations. It takes about an hour. Afterwards, there's going to be a reception for people to mingle and actually discuss how, you know, the George Eastman House has affected them, because it's been very, you know, deep-rooted in Rochester. There's a reception. You get free access to the entire George Eastman House public collections. So please, if you care to RSVP, go to asme.org. Just type in Rochester. You'll find our section's website, and you can RSVP from that site.
If you love history, it is just great fun to see what kind of machines and devices were used to capture these images. So as we get ready to wrap here, Todd, what image in history to you stands out as the most, maybe the most unlikely or the most poignant image in your mind? What comes first?
Oh, probably the image of my friend's dog. He's a great guy.
Is it Frank? Is it the guy who called
no,
Frank's
no,
dog?
It's
you would need to know, Frank.
It would be an image of Titan. Seriously, it's really hard to get into this stuff. I mean, there's so many iconic images mm-hmm. in the collection. One of the ones that I'm looking at and putting in on the first page of my upcoming book is a portrait of an artist taken by Daguerre. So an image taken by the, you know, photographic image by the inventor of the process. I think that's pretty special.
And John?
I can't pass on the chance to say the fact that they chose to photograph the entire surface of the moon in preparation for being able to land astronauts there. And Todd tells the story about, at that point you took the pictures, then you developed them in the space, in the orbiting device,
right.
Then you scanned them and you
right.
sent that signal
yeah.
back. There was no digital photography.
Right.
That's an incredible, those pictures are an incredible piece of work.
And they are incredible. About 20 seconds. Brad?
My favorite picture is actually a lunar orbiter picture. It's the first photograph of Earth from deep space, and I'll be showing that Monday night.
Beautiful.
Yeah, we have that.
Have a great time Monday night, and thank you to a great panel. You just heard Brad Paxton, member of the Technology Collection Acquisitions Committee at the Eastman House. Thank you, Brad. Todd Gustafson, the curator of the Technology Collection at the Eastman House. Thank you so much, Todd. We're going to come back and we'll just do an hour quizzing you. I would love that. Todd would have no problem with that. John Kriegel, who really got this ball rolling 11 years ago. Thank you so much, John. It's been great talking to you. And Joseph Lawson is the president of the Rochester section of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you.
John Andrus is our engineer. Thank you, John. Ra Ra Rye provides the music for the program, and our thanks to Barsook Records for that. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.